This is a real honor to have Dr. Lalingam Sherga for our podcast on legends in neurosurgery. Dr. Lalingam Sherga doesn't need an introduction for neurosurgeons. His contribution to vascular surgery and skull-based surgery are immense. And I really appreciate Dr. Sherga taking time out from his very busy practice to share with us his experience of his career. Dr. Sherga, thank you. If I may ask you a few questions to take through from the beginning of your life to career so far, I hope that will be okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, please.
Thank you. So do you want to tell us about your beginning? We know that you are in Seattle, and I know where you are from, but for the others, were you born and your grew up and went to medical school?
Yeah, I grew up in India. You know, I was born in India. I grew up in India. I was born in a city that was called Madras. Now it's called Chennai. It's in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. And then I grew up in a fairly small town at that time. Now it's much bigger, called Dharmapuri. And my father was a general practitioner. And then I went to college in Madras, Loyola College, which is a Jesuit college, and then to Madras Medical College. And I graduated as the top student of the class. And then about a year after, then I moved to the U.S. You know, I studied or passed the examination ECFMG, and I moved to the U.S.
So you are from a medical family. Do you think that influenced your direction to medicine?
Yeah. Well, that is actually true. My inclination and passion were not medicine. I wanted to become an engineer, and my younger uncle was an engineer in the railways, and he was always my hero. However, my father was very adamant that I should become a doctor. And in those days, in India, I don't know how it is now, but when your father says something, you don't go against your father. I was actually quite unhappy studying biology. It was not one of my favorite topics. Although in every single subject that I studied, I still was at the top of the class. And the first time I found that I started to like something was anatomy and physiology. When we started doing anatomical dissections, I felt like I could really, like it. And the physiology of the body, human body, I liked it. So that's how I became a doctor. And then again, the choice of becoming a neurosurgeon was really not, it wasn't decided. My father actually didn't insist on anything. My initial inclination was to become an internist. But at that time, I wanted to be a specialist in something. And, all these specialties were not very well developed in India. So I decided, okay, I'll become a surgeon. Then I thought about becoming a cardiothoracic surgeon because we had a very famous man who came back from the U.S. His name is Victor Solomon. He had come back from U.S. and he actually did some surgery. We used to go and watch him. But then I felt that, cardiac surgery didn't have enough of a challenge for the future. So I was always interested in things that posed challenges. I wanted to solve problems. So I came back full circle to neurosurgery, and so happened that my father's very close friend and classmate was Professor Ramamurthy, who was a very famous man in India. He's passed away. He built a neurological institute in Madras. So he had an influence on me, definitely. It was always almost like a reverse influence because his personality was such that, he was overbearing in many ways, like professors in the old days. But then I eventually decided to become a neurosurgeon, and then, you know, I came to the U.S.
And is there anything particular that made you neurosurgery? Is there one particular reason that you decided neurosurgery? Was it the challenge, or was it for Professor Ramamurthy?
Main thing was that I felt that there were many problems that needed to be solved, and I could be a part of that, you know, solving problems and developing new things and so on. And the brain definitely had some fascination for me, you know, so that's I didn't really, you know, if when I talk to the medical students that come and interview with me nowadays, many of them, I ask them, how did you become a neurosurgeon? They say that, well, you know what, at the age of five, I knew that I wanted to be a neurosurgeon. And I wanted to be this, I wanted to be that. And I studied neuroscience, I did that. And that was not so in my case. It was a circuitous path. And, you know, I'm a very spiritual person. I consider myself a Hindu and Buddhist. And I have very strong feelings about the Brahman, who exists everywhere and influences everything. So I finally felt that this was kind of my karma. I was kind of designated to do this in my current lifetime, mm-hmm. and to, you know, help patients, solve problems, develop new things, and serve people, you know, which is the most important thing. So it seems like, and I found my calling. And even the technical aspect of surgery, which I seem to have developed quite a bit, it was a late discovery, you know, during residency that I felt like I could do this. So it almost seemed like I fell into something, a path that had been preset. And I just needed to get into that groove, you know, so.
That's great. And you come to US, did you? Where did you land? Were you initially in New York, or were you in Pittsburgh from the
beginning? Right, yeah. I actually came to New York initially, but then I did internship at Cook County Hospital in Chicago for a year and a half. And then I interviewed for different residency positions. It was very difficult for a foreign graduate to get into a good training program. That even now it is difficult, of course, and which is understandable. You know, due to my credentials, I could get some interviews, different places, and Professor Ramamurthy was also very helpful to me because he was known, and he, you know, talked to or wrote to some people and so on. I somehow liked the program in the University of Pittsburgh a lot, mm-hmm. and I wanted to go there, but I had to wait for another year, so I decided to do 1 year of neurology at the University of Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. That also helped me, because many neurosurgeons these days, they go straight into neurosurgery, but having done a year of neurology gave me a very good clinical background, you know, in diagnosis and treatment, and the way that neurologists see patients is different from the way neurosurgeons look at them. So then I moved to the University of Pittsburgh to do the residency at the in neurosurgery. I think it was 1977.
That's great. And as you said, you know, Pittsburgh was even then world famous with Professor Genetta, I would think so. So it would have been a tough program to get into. As you said, coming from a foreign country, it's people already recognized you. And how was your residency? Was your residency, you know, we all say residency is tough.
Yeah.
Was your residency smooth in the sense that you flowered and everyone recognized you, or you had to prove yourself? Or
right.
Did you have always, you know, when you start to show talent, then you have got people who try to bring you. So how was your residency like? Was it all smooth sail?
That's a very good question. Yeah. You know, there was always some kind of a stigma against foreign graduates that they were not equal to the U.S. grads. And the residency program in the University of Pittsburgh was very difficult. And I started first at Children's Hospital, which was a very difficult rotation, and I was on call every other night, And then on nights, when I was not on call, I would go home at about 9 o'clock in the evening. And I'd be driving through an area called Shenley Park, right next to the university, to go to where I was living. And a couple of times I fell asleep at the wheel, you know. And I suddenly realized that something was wrong when a car was coming in the opposite direction. So anyway, then I started as a junior resident. And the first time that people knew that I was a little different was that we took the neurosurgery primary board exam. And, you know, which those days, you know, the junior residents would score 0 percentile or sometimes minus 20%. And I scored in the 77th percentile, mm-hmm. which was higher than all the other residents in the program, including the chief and senior and chief residents. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, I became a kind of a marked man, mm-hmm. and people realized that I was different. And, you know, my primary interest, although Dr. Janetta is extremely well known for microvascular decompression procedures and, you know, a lot of other things, he's a great, you know, very good microsurgeon. My primary interest somehow right in the beginning was in cerebrovascular neurosurgery. And one of our attendings there, his name was Roberto Hiros. He came from Mass General and, you know, he was a primary cerebrovascular surgeon there. And I kind of liked his personality and so forth. So I moved, you know, in the second year I went to the Veterans Hospital where we had, more time. And I did a lot of microsurgical training on rats, doing a lot of bypasses and vascular dissections and things like that. And I also did two research projects which involved microsurgery. One was to create artificial aneurysms. The other one was I was trying to create an artificial model of AV malformations in dogs, where I had to actually find the dissect the superficial temporal vein of the dog and suture it to the artery, which is not an easy, it's actually quite difficult. But those types of things gave me a very good training in cerebrovascular surgery. And then of course, the residency continued and it went on. And what's interesting in Pittsburgh is a couple things that we had some very illustrious people that were attendings, but also some of my residents, co-residents, people who are not necessarily at the same level, but more senior, a number of them became famous. One is Dr. Dade Lunsford, who innovated or pioneered gamma knife radiosurgery in the U.S. And then we had Dr. Paul Nelson, who would not be known very well outside, but he was a pituitary surgeon. He was like 3 years senior to me, 3 or 4 years. He was a very kind man, always very interested in me and so forth. Then Dr. Leland Albright, he was a pediatric neurosurgeon. You know, he's very well known. So a lot of people from Pittsburgh, you know, Pittsburgh was the center for innovation. It always, Dr. Janetta set the pace for innovation. So that became a very very defining motto or defining tone for the place, you know.
The standards were set high from the very beginning there, was it?
Yes, exactly. The standards were set very high. And another person I wanted to mention is Dr. John Moosey, who was a neuropathologist. We spent 6 months in neuropathology at the time, but he was also a neurologist. So we also learned a lot of neurology from him. And in the primary board exam, the final exam, I scored in the 100th percentile, which was, you know, Dr. Janetta written, still I have it somewhere. Mm-hmm. He said, you must be number one in the country. Mm-hmm. So he was very proud. So when I finished training, again, my principal aim was to become a cerebrovascular neurosurgeon. And Dr. Janetta didn't want me to leave Pittsburgh. He wanted to keep me at the VA hospital. But then I went and looked at different places and I couldn't find a good job, cerebrovascular job. Around this time, Professor Majid Sami from Germany, he had come to Pittsburgh. He was actually a friend of Dr. Janetta. and he came and gave a lecture about different things, you know, that he does. And he's a very charismatic man and very, very smooth, very suave and polished. So Dr. Janetta said, well, I want you to go to Germany and learn about peripheral nerve surgery. You know, and at this time I thought, okay, maybe I will do it, you know. But I didn't know at the time that Dr. Janetta had offered the same job to two people before me, Dr. Steve Haynes and Parvis Bagai, both of whom declined. Mm-hmm. So I was like the third guy. I didn't know that they were people ahead of me, you know, in the residency. So I decided to, I had to learn some German. And strangely enough, you know, in Pittsburgh at the time, it was very difficult to learn German. You could go to one of these big organizations that was very expensive. Mm-hmm. So I hired a tutor for me and my wife. Mm-hmm. The man actually is originally from Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bengali was his first language. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Germany and he learned German. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Brazil. His wife was Brazilian, and then he came back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. So English was like his third language, you know, and he taught German. So anyway, I learned some German, and I went to Germany. And that was a turning point in my life because Professor Sami, by this time, had shifted his focus to this area, which he called skull-based surgery, mm-hmm. Although it was not a defined or distinct discipline at that time. And he was mainly interested in, you know, acoustic neuromas and some meningiomas at the base and some procedures he would do with ENT. Mm-hmm. And he knew that I was mainly interested in cerebrovascular surgery. And he, but he spent a lot of time with me, mm-hmm. you know, giving me philosophical talks and saying that, well, you know what, nobody can do anything more than Yashagil and Drake, therefore you should, you know, you should try to go into this area. One thing I forgot to mention is that when I was a resident, I also spent about 5 weeks with Dr. Charlie Drake up in London, Ontario, and I was very impressed with him and his surgery and so on. And if I'm not in the operating room, I would watch their videotapes, which were all unedited videotapes. Mm-hmm. In those days, they used to just store them in one room. I used to watch them, he and Dr. Skip Peerless. Mm-hmm. But he, that had a big, he in time had a big influence on what I had to, what I did. So anyway, so I spent time with Sami, and again, I met some very good people there that were co-residents. One of them to mention, I want to mention, is Dr. Ricardo Ramina, who was, you know, in now in Brazil, really one of the most famous neurosurgeons there. Dr. Kiki Turrell, who was in Mumbai, mm-hmm. he was a resident had been a fellow with Dr. Sami. Anyway, then after I did that, I wanted to spend a little more time in Europe, and Dr. Janetta gave me that time was a princely amount, $10,000.
Wow.
He said, you can go here and there. So mm-hmm. I spent 6 weeks with Gazi Yasigal mm-hmm. in Zurich. And Gazi was a very, very interesting person, mm-hmm. very different in personality from Sami. Sami is very polished and smooth, and very rarely did he get upset or visibly upset. Gazi was the exact opposite. And yet, his mastery of the brain anatomy and his handling of blood vessels was something that I had not seen before. So it was amazing. Mm-hmm. They are both great technical surgeons, but Professor Yasigal was different. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that Dr. Yasigal did not like people from the U.S.
Okay.
He himself, you know, was a person of Turkish origin working in Zurich, which, you know, very difficult at that time to succeed. Mm-hmm. But he felt like the American surgeons were coming there just to see him and criticize him. Mm-hmm. But he developed some sort of a liking for me for a couple of reasons. Maybe one was my Indian origin. The second, perhaps, was the fact that I came from Dr. Janetta and he was friendly with Dr. Janetta. Mm-hmm. And over the years, Dr. Yasigal has always been my supporter. In whatever I do, he would listen to my presentations. he come and talk to me, and he would give me some very constructive criticism, which is very nice of him. He'd just talk to me very openly about that. Then I spent a little bit of time in France with Patrick Derome. And I also came to the UK to spend some time with Professor Lindsay Simon. Mm-hmm. And I have to say honestly that Lindsay Simon was the least impressive of the people that I had seen. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the surgical technique in the UK was ages behind both Germany and even the US. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came back to, then I came and joined the faculty at the University of Pittsburgh after that.
And you obviously touched on huge figures in neurosurgery, and you became one of them. And what, one can have as much technical skills or intellect, but what was the thing that made Majid Sami, Dr. Majid Sami, Majid Sami, and what made Dr. Jasagil, Dr. Jasagil? What was the, if there is something that it was intrinsic about them as a person that made them that great?
Right. I think that both Professor, let's talk a little bit about Professor Sami. Mm-hmm. Professor Sami was different in the sense that he was a great technical surgeon, but also he could handle people. He could handle an organization very well. So he had an entire group of people at Nordstadt Krankenhaus, which means the hospital in the north of the city. This is a city hospital. And he came there, and he had come from Mainz, where he had been under Professor Schurmann. And Professor Schurmann was his big supporter. But he would be operating in four or five operating rooms every day. Mm-hmm. And there were a whole bunch of people. You know, for instance, I'd be one room, and all I would do is just to open a retrosigmoid craniotomy and prepare everything for acoustic neuroma operation, and he will come and he'll take the tumor out and he'll move to the next room. Mm-hmm. So in the afternoon, he'll just drink some tea, and he'll talk to you very nicely. And some big operations, sometimes the his chief resident or his assistant doctors, Oberarzt, what they call Oberarzt, they would do, like big meningiomas and some peripheral nerve procedures and so on. And he had a big entourage of people. Some were German and many were foreign people, foreign origin people. And it was a very interesting, like a family there, and me and my wife, we stayed in an apartment in the nurse's quarters, and we'd go here and there. And Dr. Ramina and his wife took us in different places. But thing about Sami was that he was especially remarkably good at just about everything he did, mm-hmm. but he did not like vascular surgery. This is very interesting. He would not treat aneurysms, very rare. I saw the whole time I was there, maybe three or four, and in fact, I ended up doing a couple of them or guiding a couple when he was away. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to Jasagil, it's very, very different. He was just in one operating room. Mm-hmm. And then maybe in the other OR, one of his assistants would be there, mm-hmm. and he would go, and see that person. In order to watch Jasagil, you had to come very quietly and then go and sit in a bench in the corner. You can't move, you can't, speak, and all these things, he said, it bothered him. And not only did he, was he doing the surgery, he said, everything he was listening, he said he wanted to listen to the suction, and he said that he wanted to, he didn't want to be distracted by people speaking and so on. And what's interesting is that years later, I'm a bit like him now, but I'm not aggressive like him, but I don't like people talking constantly in the background because I find that it disturbs my concentration on what I'm working on, because I'm frequently working on something very difficult. So I kind of understand where he was, and but the way that he handled the blood vessels, the anatomy, the way he didn't need navigation, he knew where to go, this was amazing to me. I feel that, I'm just telling you honestly, I'm a better technical vascular surgeon today than he was, but you have to imagine that I'm standing on his shoulders 30, 40 years hence, you know. So things have moved along, but he was also amazing person. And on Fridays, I would go and watch Dr. Ugo Fish, who was actually ENT surgeon, who was, you know, working in the ENT OR, and that was also interesting. One thing I forgot to mention is that Majid Sami had developed this relationship or collaboration with some ENT and other people. Although he didn't work with them very much, they would kind of get together and discuss some problems, you know, once every 6 months or so. So that was something also very interesting. And this relationship, the sort of thing with Majid continued, you know, for a long time.
That's wonderful synopsis of those people for us to know who never worked or worked or seen operating. And then you come back to States and you feel better for your European trip. And did you feel that when you came back that you were now at a different level?
I definitely felt that I was at a different level. And of course, I was appointed as an assistant professor. I was, you know, doing lots of things, trauma and spine and vascular. But what's interesting at the time is that I was not the principal cerebrovascular surgeon. We had another guy, senior guy called Howard Jonas. Unfortunately, I was much better technically than him. So he was always afraid of me. And he was afraid also because I was locally grown, you know, that I will take over his job. So he was, you know, he was always very jealous. But at this time, what happened was that the ENT people that were working in Pittsburgh, they had no one to work with. And mainly the interaction was they would create complications. It'll be CSF leak or major strokes or something, then they'll call neurosurgery. And neurosurgeons absolutely hated them. There was only one person who had done work with the ENT, that was Dr. Joseph Maroon. He is still, you know, he's back in Pittsburgh. He's one of my teachers. He had been working with another guy there called Victor Schramm, who's an ENT. So I started doing some work with Victor Schramm, mainly to prevent complications, because Victor would create major problems. So around this time, I became interested in developing, you know, this thing called skull-based surgery, but a lot of the technical problems were not worked out. So what I did was I started working in on cadavers, and I found a guy by the name of Jan Hart. To this day, he was very nice man. He was in the Department of Anatomy, but he also owned a mortuary, you know, one of these private. He knew how to prepare cadavers. His technique now is now employed by everybody. Even Dr. Rotan adopted his methods. So he would give me the heads, and I got an old OR table and old instruments and everything, and I set up a room at the University of Pittsburgh. And every Saturday, I would work there, and you know, I would be working randomly on something. I just knew where to go. I didn't know how to get there. You know, I knew that I need to get to the base. I knew where I need to get to the blood vessels. I didn't know how to get there. So I started working on these things, and then I had people working with me. So Victor Schramm and I did a little bit of work, and then he left. So we hired a new person. The chairman of ENT, Dr. Gene Myers, was very supportive of this idea of working together. So we hired this person called Ivo Janica, who was a very interesting man. He is not only an ENT, but he's also board certified in plastic surgery. Very, very elegant surgeon. So at this time, I had the idea of creating what I call the Center for Cranial-Based Surgery, which will kind of bring together the various disciplines of not only neurosurgery, ENT, plastic surgery, radiology, and so on. And this type of thing didn't exist before. About this time, I also had the idea of how to reconstruct the cranial base. I mean, you could do all sorts of damage there, but if you can't fix it, You know, if you can't prevent CSF leak and infection, if you can't make the patient look good. So we started working with plastic surgery, and I had this idea of microvascular flap transfer from a conference which I attended. They were talking about it for the first time, but I said, why don't we apply it to a skull base? So we found a plastic surgeon who could do this free flap transfers. So then we developed this group of, you know, neurosurgery, ENT, plastics, and radiology, and so on and so forth. And Dr. Chandranath Sen, who was who came initially there as a fellow to work under Dr. Genera, he became interested in skull base. He worked with me as my partner. And then Dr. Don Wright came later at a later time. But we developed an entire group of people that, you know, worked towards a common goal. I think that this, I see this as the most major and important accomplishment. It is not that, you know, everything had to fall in place. Let's say you had to have a unique approach to go there. You need to figure out, you know, how to remove the tumor from the blood vessels, or you need to do, you know, how to do a bypass, or how to clip an aneurysm, how to close. But somebody has to put everything together, you know, the orchestrated team. And that, I believe, was the most important achievement. And, you know, around this time, we started meeting with other people in other places. And this, the Pittsburgh model became a model for centers of cranial-based surgery in many places. And, you know, Dr. Al Rotan was a very strong supporter, because he primarily was interested in anatomy. And he saw this as the application of anatomy. And he kind of adopted me as one of his students. And then, of course, Dr. Al-Mefti was working in a different place. But and Al-Mefti is an individualist. He's more like a Yasuko. You know, he wanted to do everything by himself. He's a great surgeon and a very independent thinker. He was he came from a different background. Then we had other people like ENT, Dr. Daryl Brackman, who was from, you know, the Hausier Institute, Paul Donald, who was head and neck. So all of these people, we started getting together, and, you know, we established the North American Skull-Based Society. And eventually, with due to the stimulation of Professor Sami, I was able to somehow negotiate Sami and Ugo Fish, because Sami was my mentor, Ugo Fish was my friend. So we were able to kind of merge these two major groups together to form this World Federation, because there was just two distinct, you know, let's say warring groups of people, one based in neurosurgery, one based in ENT. So the sort of the World Federation came together. But I have to go back to saying that the model of working together and looking at problems became a very important model going forward. And skull-based surgery, I say, was born as a distinct specialty, in my opinion. Perhaps Professor Sami was a major induction, but it really had its birth at the University of Pittsburgh.
So would you say that although the idea of working with the ENT was with Dr. Sami, but the formation of neurosurgeons, ENT, plastic, radiology, in forming into a group was first done in Pittsburgh? Would that be a fair?
Yes, absolutely. Question? Exactly. Yes.
That's brilliant. And, you know, I mean, I've been in neurosurgery long now. And even, you know, in my first day, I probably started in neurosurgery. You were already a legend back in the early 1990s. So, you know, that was very, you know, that time you were very young. And even then you were a world-renowned neurosurgeon. How, you know, your rise, you know, if I calculate the ages right, you know, it was pretty meteoric. How quickly, how is that that you went so your lift off was such vertical, you know, how was that you became well recognized so quickly in a young age?
Well, when we started with this new field of skull-based surgery, as you might expect, there was a lot of resistance from some of the established neurosurgeons. In fact, Professor Robert Ogeman, who's from Mass General, he's one of the, let's say, the stalwarts of organizational neurosurgery. is an outstanding acoustic neuromasseurgeon. He wrote a scathing editorial in the Journal of Neurosurgery after the publication of one of my papers there. Dr. Thor Sundt was the editor of Journal of Neurosurgery. He was actually surprisingly very supportive of me because he wanted to see new things develop. And I have to say, I have to give a lot of credit to Dr. Thor Sundt because I never worked with him as such. But, you know, what's interesting is that I had read his various papers. And I did an operation on a patient in Pittsburgh. She had a recurrent meningioma. And, you know, the carotid artery was encased. And I just, you know, came across the artery. But she had cross flow on the angiogram. So I said, okay, she should be fine. But she woke up hemiplegic. So immediately I said, oh, we got to do something here. I think we need to do a vein graft. And I had never seen a vein graft before. And I'd only read about a vein graft by reading Dr. Thorson's papers into the middle cerebral artery. And he used to cut the artery using a very brand new scalpel blade and a slit. He would make a slit. So I sort of did a vein graft, and that lady actually recovered. She had a little bit of a revascularization hemorrhage, but she completely recovered. So that was the, and then I read a lot of his papers, you know, and I worked on many kinds of revascularization procedures, including the radial artery graft procedures and so on. So he really is one of my great heroes. But nevertheless, I wanted to say that initially there was a lot of resistance. At the same time, some neurosurgeons started showing some interest in this area. For instance, Vinko Dolenz, for instance, is another person who developed a lot of things in Europe, and he used to come to the U.S. and give some lectures. And something interesting happened at this time. If you ask a neurosurgeon, what is the technically most important procedure that you do in cranial neurosurgery, they'd say it's the STA-MCA bypass. So the STA-MCA bypass defined technical excellence in neurosurgery at the time. But there was a major international trial that was conducted that the results were negative, that it showed that, you know, STA-MCA bypass in general for stroke was not, did not really help the patients. I mean, there's probably a very well-defined indication, but that particular procedure. So suddenly neurosurgeons were left searching for the next big thing. And skull-based surgery was a baby that was already growing. So a lot of people became interested in skull-based surgery. So that's what happened. And I wanted to mention that when I moved to George Washington University Hospital as a chairman and a director, I became director of Neuroscience Institute there, I started focusing more on application of skull-based techniques to vascular surgery and also developing bypass procedures, which I've continued to this day. But that is because in Pittsburgh, I couldn't have done that. You know, there was would have been a lot of resistance, and I was able to do that. And around, you know, let's say late 90s, and then, of course, in 2000s, endovascular surgery developed. And I actually underwent endovascular training because I felt like this is a new area. This is going to replace. And, of course, it has replaced a lot of microsurgery that we do, but still, you know, cranial surgery and bypass procedures remain important. And the combination of skull-based surgery and, you know, aneurysm aneurysms and bypasses, all these things combined together. The other thing that developed is also endoscopic surgery, which again became a very important element of what we do. The question is, you know, how much should be done open and how much should be done endoscopic? And another point should be mentioned is radiosurgery, because radiosurgery also became important. So some of the very aggressive procedures we do, we have kind of toned them down. We're sometimes more conservative in doing certain types of operations. We've also reduced the exposures that we need to do we don't always need to expose a lot of things in a big way. So we have sort of minimized and doing now just what we need to do. Another thing is the training. We did a lot of courses, fellows, residents, and they in turn have gone on to train more people. So the training became an important aspect of this as well.
And in terms of, in neurosurgery, it's very hard to be recognized locally, let alone regionally, let alone nationally. And what were the landmark things that you did that put you on a on your that you became recognized? Because people know that certain things when you do that, this is a class, a person of different class. And what were the things that you did that told other people that you are a different class?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't really know. How do you know that a person is from a different class? You know, when you ask a person, okay, or do you know Dr. Robert Spetzler? Yes, of course. Every person in your city knows Robert Spetzler. But why is he famous? You know, is he famous because he, published his classification of AVMs, or he did a lot, 5,000 aneurysms, or what is the reason? You know, I don't know. I think that if I look back on my career to this day, the key things that I did are, number one, is the development of skull-based surgery as a team concept. There are lots of little things, developing approaches, developing ways to take out tumors, reconstructing blood vessels, reconstructing cranial nerves, all these things. But I think putting everything together, I think is a very important one. The second is, I believe, the development of various specialized approaches for aneurysms and the development of bypasses. I think that this is going to go, going to be a very important aspect of recognition. The last element that I want to mention is that as years have gone by, people do recognize that I'm a spiritual person, that perhaps I'm a humble person. I'm not somebody who is, very arrogant. I don't know if people perceive, but I think people perceive me that way, that I don't, rest on my achievements and laurels, and I feel that everybody has contributed something. So maybe that's something also important, that perhaps people see that.
I think, do you think the fact that you mentor and you bring up fellows, and then you have a school, the fact that mentoring makes, as one of my colleagues used to say, you can become if you're technically excellent, you are great for surgeon, but when you give your time and your generosity, then you become, that's when you become the grade five legend. Is that something that you recognize? You think that's the difference between great and legend?
I have had this discussion with our residents and fellows. What makes a person a great rather than a good neurosurgeon? And it's very interesting. Something that happened, Dr. Robinson Gupta from Newcastle, whom you know, I'm sure many neurosurgeons in the UK know him. He was a very famous aneurysm surgeon, and he was my friend. And he was telling me once, and Shaker, he said, you know what happened? He said, I had a big, giant cavernous aneurysm. At that time, I used to be doing bypasses for them. He said, well, there was a good cross flow, so I just put a clip on the carotid artery, and I thought that'll be okay. But the patient woke up hemiplegic, and I left town, and then she developed brain swelling and died. But he said, well, the patient actually would have survived if I'd been there, because I would have done a decompression, and it was the right hemisphere, it wasn't so bad. He told me, Shaker, only the surgeon of the patient knows. He said, when you are away, every one of your colleagues will do what is the right thing for the patient, but only the surgeon will do more than what is right. Only the surgeon feels and cares. So in my opinion, the greatness of a neurosurgeon comes from a couple of things. One is attention to detail. We have to pay a great deal of attention to detail in every case that we do. The second is self-knowledge. So knowing what you can do and what you can't do, and then moderating your approach accordingly. And the third is caring for the patient, you know, constantly thinking about your patients. I had a very important fellow. He is now a very famous professor in Chicago. His name is Jim Chandler. So Jim asked my, you know, former wife, why is Shaker so good at neurosurgery? And why is he? And well, she told him very simple thing, because he's thinking about it all the time. So this is very interesting, because I didn't know about it myself, but I think about my patients, my, you know, what did I do differently? What could have been done differently? You know, and I even pray for them to recover and so on. So I'm constantly thinking about them. So I think that those things really make a great neurosurgeon. So a person becomes a great neurosurgeon, in my opinion, not by being technically the most, the brilliant person, but being, you know, the three things that I mentioned, you know, that the attention to detail, self-awareness, and thinking and caring, not only for, of course, the patients, but also your team, you know, treating everybody kindly and getting along with them.
That's great. Thanks. You know, there's never, you know, as you go up your profession, you're always going to get people who kind of appreciate you and support you. And then there are going to be people who criticize you. How did you deal with criticisms without that pulling you down?
That's a very good question, actually, the criticism aspect. I think I learned some things from Dr. Janetta and Dr. Sami and Yasagil, and not so much from Drake, because Drake must have faced a lot of criticism, you know, as he was young. So one thing very interesting happened when I was in Pittsburgh. I had this developed this center there, and then we had myself and Dr. Sen. And we had a nurse, her name is Lois Burkhart. She was following up all the patients, and we had a database. She was recording the outcomes and so on. And Dr. Paul Nelson was the chief of the hospital, Presbyterian Hospital, but Dr. Janetta was the chairman. So I was promoted as associate professor. And then within 2 years, Dr. Janetta said he wanted to promote me to professor. Mm-hmm. So he asked some other people to, you know, their opinion and to write letters of recommendation. So he called me in one day and he said, Sheikh, he said that you are a great person, but some people have complained that the results of your publications, what you're publishing, is not true, that you are, you know, essentially falsifying the results. That was the accusation. He said, well, you know, maybe you're just embellishing something. You need to take care about this. And I think that one of my fellows, whom I suspect was working with me, may have, you know, lodged some sort of a complaint. I don't know exactly. Anyway, so I became very upset by that. Mm-hmm. And I told Dr. Paul Nelson. Dr. Paul Nelson was like my 3-year senior. And he was one of the most important supporters of skull-based surgery in Pittsburgh, much more than Dr. Janetta, interestingly. So Paul said to me, okay, Sheikh, let's do this. Give me your last 50 patients, consecutive cases. And whatever it is that you have recorded as the results, and I'm going to have an independent quality assurance evaluation. Mm-hmm. So he asked the nurses in the hospital to call every one of those patients to find out how they were doing and record it. And then he looked at the results. They were identical. So after that, Dr. Janetta shut up and nobody else. And at that time, I felt like also Dr. Janetta was a little jealous because what had happened I was like a son. But I became the most famous son, almost eclipsing what he was doing at the time, because, I would get visitors, and many, many visitors, they would come to visit me, and very few people were coming to see him at the time, because everybody knew what, he was doing. And this was a little unfortunate, because I was not his favorite son. His favorite son was another guy by the name of my senior, Steve Haynes. You know, in fact,
Minnesota,
was,
who was in Minnesota, I said.
He was in Minnesota, exactly. And Steve, did some research in microvascular decompression procedures. And Dr. Janetta felt like he was, that he should be the one to succeed him. And interestingly enough, Steve was, typical, establishment person from the U.S. His father was a neurosurgeon in upstate New York, and he was very soft-spoken and very, very kind, very nice man, good surgeon. So years later, when Dr. Janetta retired, I was asked to come and look at the chairmanship at the University of Pittsburgh, and I was one of the candidates, me and Steve Haynes and Dade Lunsford and Art Day. We were the finalists, and Dr. Janetta actively put me down. He told everybody, no, he's not the person for this job, and so on and so forth. He promoted Steve Haynes, but unfortunately, none of the three got the job, and Dade was eventually appointed as the chairman. But why I mention that is that, so then I realized that Dr. Janetta had faced a lot of criticism in his life and career as well. And he had a very angry way of reacting. I remember that he reacted very badly in some national meetings and so on. Dr. Yasugil the same, but Professor Sami was the exact opposite. He was, you can criticize him, of course, and he will kind of listen to it, and it'll go over. So I felt that one has to learn. Each one of us has to learn the way. Yes, we have to understand critique. We have to respond to it. At the same time, should not be upset by it, which is very, very difficult. It should have a positive effect. At the same time, when we criticize somebody, we should do it in a way that it is helpful to that person. It helps them, you can say, well, this is my opinion. Perhaps you can, think about it a different way. Or this is why the way I do it. I'm not saying what you're doing is wrong. So it allows the person to reflect on what they're doing and change their behavior. So this is, human interaction. None of us are really educated or trained in our lifetime, in our schools and so on, how to do this.
And you mentioned that, when Dr. Janetta would respond to criticism more vociferously or more angrily, and you have this when you go through, people go through their training, and you have people who try to pull down or try to knock. How do you not have a bitterness as you progress, that love those people? How do you make that? Because otherwise these just always hangs in your head. What's your advice for, how did you dealt with Dr. Janetta trying to criticize you, and how did you forgive him, or did you, it was always something that grated?
So Dr. Janetta criticizing me is a different thing, because he's like the father telling the son. So I view that at a different level. In general, when you go to meetings or meet colleagues and they criticize you and so on, I think that everything should be built on the basis of personal relationships. So I am your friend. I'm a friend of Babaji. So yes, Babaji is allowed to criticize me in any way he wants. But at the end of the day, it's a purely an academic discussion. We get off that, and then we go and have a drink, or we eat a meal together. We talk about our families. We talk about what we do. We play golf, or we play tennis, or whatever. We are still friends. I think that that is important. I really try, even with the, my residents and fellows and nurses and so on, and I tell them, get to know the people. Mm-hmm. Know their name, know their family, know their likes and dislikes, mm-hmm. Take a personal interest in them, you know, and do the same with them. So when they are your friends, when they view you as not an adversary, then it doesn't matter. You know, it's not like Ukrainians fighting Russians. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to kill you. Yeah. They may be, you know, trying to put you down in some way because they want to score some points and achieve some prominence. Mm-hmm. But the audience, they can make their own judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to say, okay, this is my experience. You know, there's a, for instance, there's some controversy between endoscopic and open skull-based surgery for certain things, or endovascular and open microsurgery, or gamma knife and so on. So we can all have discussions. Mm-hmm. We can all show our results. We can have, and yet we can be friends, you know, and people can make their own judgments. And, you know, at the end of the day, in different scenarios, that person may be right and you may be right in other scenarios. Mm-hmm. And what works for you may not be, you know, working for them. Today, you know, I was just a visiting professor in Pittsburgh about 3-4 weeks ago. University of Pittsburgh now is developed as a center for endoscopic skull-based surgery. Mm-hmm. They don't do very much of open skull-based surgery. Whereas in our place in Seattle, we do both open and endoscopic, but maybe not as aggressive endoscopic as they do. So, but still, it doesn't mean that they are right and I'm, or they are wrong and I'm right. So it's just what they have done. Mm-hmm. And somebody will like that and they will take that part forward, and someone will like what I'm doing. So I think the personal relationship, personal friendship, and personal respect for the other human being is very important. And I come back to the philosophy aspect of this. According to our Hindu philosophy, we feel that every single living being and even non-living things are manifestations of the Brahman. Mm-hmm. Brahman is, you know, our concept of limitless God, let's say. And the aspect of Brahman exists inside each one of us. You know, this morning I went to Starbucks and ordered a coffee. And the baristas, they are doing their job. When they give you the best coffee, perfect coffee, they are doing a phenomenal job. Mm-hmm. So that's just as important, because they make your day start well. And this is equally important. So the nurses, the janitors in the hospital, every single person who's doing their job is doing something important. So if we look at it that way, mm-hmm. develop respect for the other person, you know, everything kind of boils down. It melts down to, okay, so it's not such a big conflict. It's just, you know, their opinion and their experience. You can try to influence them, you know, so.
Thank you. Dr. Shagar, in terms of being a skull-based surgeon, it's a lifetime of obsession in knowing absolutely. And if to be a very good skull-based surgeon, if I had decided, then, you know, I wanted a lab and I wanted to have absolutely immersed myself. And how would you advise in terms of people having semblance of family life, or females coming into skull-based surgery? Any thoughts on how you can be a skull-based surgeon and still have a life?
Yeah, I feel that it is important to have a balance of three things in life. Of course, it's easy for me to say now, but nevertheless, Dr. Joe Maroon always used to emphasize that. So we have our work life, we have our family life, and we have our personal life. Our personal life is what we are and what we think, you know, and how we think and so on, our personal happiness. Family, your spouse, your partner, your children, whatever, your dog, then your work life. We need to have a balance. there are times in which we focus excessively. We are forced to focus. For instance, residents in training are forced to focus. When I was developing skull-based surgery, I focused maybe too much on work because I was trying to do a lot of things, very difficult cases, and you know, it was not easy to do the things at the beginning. So perhaps, you know, maybe too much. So, but we need a correction. I always say, think of life in 5-year epochs. What is the next 5 years going to be? What are you going to do in the next 5 years? Now I'm 70 years old. I know what I want to do within the next 5 years. So always keep this balance. The other thing that I would say is that remain innovative. So innovation doesn't mean that you have to innovate major things, but small things in your life, in your work, make some changes that are going to help people improve things. I think this is very important because innovation, what is wonderful about children, it is their imagination. And as we get older, we should not lose this imagination and wonder, sense of wonder about everything around us. So take an interest in everything. So for instance, the biggest things now are artificial intelligence, you know, the antibody treatments of various disorders, space science, a lot of things like this, big things are there, robotics. So whatever it is that catches your fancy, but keep an open mind and take an interest in all these things. That'll keep you alive. You know, so, but I think you have to achieve this balance.
Thanks. In terms of three specific questions for skull-based surgery, or maybe general questions, in fact, you know, when you have a success, when you have successes, you know, amazing feeling being a surgeon, you know, the feet walks you to the patient. When you have a complication, that's the longest walk. And how do you deal with complications? And, you know, there comes a point, the one thing is, how do you deal with a complication? And how do you deal with a complication when you are pushing a field or even pushing yourself to go to the next level? How do you deal with it? And the third question is that when you know that Dr. Shekhar can do a better surgery than me, how do I go and do it myself rather than say to my patients, go and see Dr. Shekhar? So there are three different questions there.
Thanks. Yeah. So the first question is about complications and success. How do you handle success and complications? So I come back and, you know, by the way, I have to tell you that my father was not a very spiritual person. He was not atheist. He used to go to the temples and so on, but he was trained in the British Raj. He surprisingly had a very British outlook about things, you know. But when I moved to Madras for the first time, I stayed with my uncle, and he had a very small copy of Bhagavad Gita that I started to read it. And I, over the years, you know, I read it, and I learned a lot about Hindu philosophy. But I feel that the Bhagavad Gita gives you the answer for that. And that is, perform your duty well, but do not attach to the result. And I'll come to this in a minute. And at the same time, it says, perform your duty as a devotion to me. So meaning that whatever duty you're performing, that is your prayer. That is your dedication to me. It's not for you. So what it means, at the same time, do not be frozen in inaction. So just because you feel like a result is going to be bad, don't be frozen in action. Do what you're supposed to do. So as surgeons, we have to take care of patients. We have to act. So that is number one. But then you are going to have some complications. It is a human feeling. It is inescapable that we are going to be upset about complications. At the same time, your colleagues are very crucial. When your colleague has a complication, try to be helpful. Don't be super critical. Secondly, analyze the complication and see how can you get out of it. And in my original book, when we had a book on cranial-based tumors, I wrote something, you know, and it says, try and try very hard, but do not despair. So do not despair when you have a major complication. Try to analyze exactly what happened and how you can fix it. So once you fix it, then you go back and you have to have a learning process so that it doesn't happen again. Of course, there are cases which are already bad. There's nothing you can do. You know, you just have to do your best job. And you realize that, okay, I've done my best for the patient. At the same time, do not inflate your ego when you have great case. I have had amazing successes, but I know that my role was small. I had something divine force, and my team, everybody was pulling together and they pushing me up, and the patient. You know, I just saw this patient, met her recently in Washington, D.C. She had this giant basilar aneurysm, entire lower basilar artery was blown up, you know, and she came in with in a very bad shape, and she was 15 years old. So eventually, there was nothing we could do. So we did a temporal bone resection without damaging the facial nerve. Hearing was lost. Second day, we went in and I did a cardiac arrest to stop the, you know, circulation, did a bypass to the basilar artery, and then removed the aneurysm. The patient recovered nearly completely, except for hearing loss. She's gone on to be a mother. Has a child. She has a master's degree in psychology. She's functioning well, you know, 30 years later. The point is, we kind of put things together, but did I do it? No. I had the privilege of being something. You know, just, it was my great honor and karma that I could be there at the time. You know, so when you think about it like that, okay, then you say, yeah, then this is okay. It's wonderful. I provided a great service, but I had some really bad, I can think of at least a few cases where, you know, things didn't go well. So complications is a human thing. So then you asked me the other question about, what was that about the...
If I'm in the same city as you and I know that you are...
Another surgeon. Yes. I think that what I was saying was that you have to know yourself. The major incentive with all of us doing the certain things, there are two or three things. Number one, we want to keep the referring doctors and the patients happy. Second thing, we are serving our own ego by doing certain things. And the third could be a financial incentive. You know, many places, if you don't take care of this patient and send it to somebody else, you lose the money, whatever. And but after some time, you realize that if you don't do the right thing for the patient, all your objectives will be defeated. So number one. Number two, if you feel that somebody is consistently doing a better job than you, is it possible for you to go and observe them and learn something from them? You know, that's a lot of people do it. You know, I go and watch somebody, I learn something from them. So there's no doubt about that. So I think that should be our approach. If we can remove this financial incentive, unfortunately, that is a big thing in many countries. There is a financial incentive to keep the patient in your hands.
The other part of that question was that when you are developing, you know, you are doing well at one stage, and now you want to go to the next level of the surgery. And when you come across complication as you go through the learning curve, how do you deal with the fact that this is your learning curve and you are having a complication? How do you deal with that, whether it's a new technique or even an established technique that you are trying? How do you deal with that fact?
That's a good question. I think that you need to see if this is a one-time issue or is it a recurrent problem. If it's a one-time issue, okay, it's fine. you just analyze your steps and see what happened. If it's a recurrent problem, you need to stop what you're doing and then maybe either learn from somebody or go back to the drawing board. Yeah, I think a one-time issue, yes, everybody's allowed one big issue, one problem, complication, and then you can analyze it and then try to correct. You know, it's like going into space. Space shuttle or rocket explodes the first time. Okay, it's fine. You know, can you analyze the problems and then see what it is? You know, what's the goal? You know, we want to get to the moon and have a moon station or launch, you know, have a orbiting space station. So we know what we want to do. But if we have recurrent problems and if we're making the same mistakes, then it's not good. On the other hand, it may be a problem that is not solvable at the current time with the current technology. It takes some time and maturity to understand that. You know, I feel like skull-based surgery, the future is going to be based on a lot of things that are happening now. You know, everything is there. The knowledge of genes, knowledge of antibody, the various types of antibody treatments that are coming around, and then stem cell therapy, use of artificial intelligence and robotics. All of these are going to come together. All of these areas are already there. So somebody is going to come, not one person, but many hundreds of people, new generation will come and put these things together to develop this field, you know, push it forward. And neuro rehabilitation, you know, so many techniques for rehabilitating people who have whatever deficits, either due to our surgery or due to stroke or tumors or whatever. So that's another field, you know. So,
thanks. Last two questions, Dr. Shirka. In terms of for a young Lalingam Shirka, just you know, starting on residency the first day. Now looking back, what would you say to him that to do and or do it differently?
Yeah, I don't know. I really say that the past is the past. You know, it happened. Yeah, I really don't know what I could have done differently. Maybe I should have spent a little bit more time with my son and wife. That's one possibility. Dave Lunsford told me something very interesting. He said, Sheikh, I said, are you still traveling a lot? I said, well, moderately. He said, but I think I reduced it. He said, don't travel too much. He said, that's very bad for your family life. So this was very important advice from Dave, who, of course, also, you know, travels, but also he's always achieved this balance. So I think that's important. You know, we all want to go here and there and, you know, be with our friends and talk about our work and everything, but then it damages your family life. So we need to think about that aspect. You know, that's the only thing perhaps, you know, I would say. But other than that, no way to second guess anything that happened. It's been a journey, you know, what can I say?
And the other question, going back to your two passions, vascular and skull base. Do you think, you know, nowadays there was a generation of neurosurgeons who were both vascular and skull base, but nowadays, at least where I am seeing, they're either vascular or skull base. Do you think this is going to, what's your thoughts on this? What used to be one surgeon who can handle both and now two surgeons?
Yeah, I think that the two areas are evolving a little differently. For instance, vascular surgery has become a combination of endovascular and microsurgery. Skull base is, you know, you're talking about skull base surgery, endoscopic surgery, and so on. I feel that the skull base surgeon in particular should have very good knowledge of vascular surgery. Mm. Because everything we do with skull base relates to blood vessels and so on and so forth. You can get away with being a cerebrovascular surgeon, but you need to have some knowledge of skull-based approaches. But a lot of the surgeons we're seeing today, cerebrovascular surgeons, are purely endovascular. They have very little training in microsurgery. So we are having to focus on people to train them because it takes a much longer time to train people nowadays because the number of cases are smaller. At the same time, the cases are more complex. So that's the other thing. So I think that we still need, because we are working in the same area, using same techniques, we need to have some cross-fertilization. Although, you know, in one area you're seeing endoscopic, or on the other side in the endovascular, and then you also have radiosurgery. You know, I also do some radiosurgery, not a lot, but some. So I think that it is becoming more difficult to train people due to the number of cases, you know, and also the anxiety of the surgeons is higher. So every patient wants perfect results, and people are looking at you very critically. So you need to, so the training becomes somewhat more difficult in that environment as well. What we used to have in the old days doesn't exist anymore. I mean, at least in the US, I don't know about UK, but it is, you know, it is more difficult to train people in those circumstances.
And you mentioned earlier about being curious, and I know that, you know, we have more discussions on from quantum computers to quantum mechanics to philosophy to ethics to. Do you think that was, you know, that is a important to have that kind of a holistic view of having interest, you know, picking ideas from other things and bringing it to your work, your other interests have benefited, your surgery has benefited from your other interests, and vice versa?
I agree with you completely. The only thing I now, you asked me about residency, but I want to go back to something. I wish I had learned more mathematics, but I learned everything I could in my framework, because for instance, I never studied calculus. So I had, you know, I had algebra, I had trigonometry, geometry, all those things. But in high school, there was no calculus taught. So in order to learn calculus, I had to be in college. So today I wish that I had learned calculus. And I wish, you know, I went back and relearned some math, but not calculus. I don't have a teacher to teach me calculus. And I feel like today, growing up, I would like to learn more about programming computers and writing, you know, programs, and how do they work. I'm doing some research that pertains to space science. So I'm working a lot with engineers. But it's also something else I wish I had learned is I don't have a background in music. And after I came to the U.S., I realized that I love Western classical music, which is very interesting, because growing up in India, we never listened to Eastern or, you know, Indian classical music, South Indian classical music, which is very different. But I wish that I had learned something about Western classical music, because I feel that the people of talented musicians, like Beethoven or Mendelssohn or Tchaikovsky, these people, they have the same creative process that, you know, drives us as doctors and neurosurgeons. And we need to, you know, Dr. Janetta, it was very interesting because he always would choose people in his residency that were doing some sports and that could play an instrument. And I was not, surprisingly, he took me, and I used to play cricket, but he didn't know that at the time. And I also played tennis. I'm relatively fairly good at tennis, but I picked it up a lot later. So I was not really good at any sports, and I had not played any musical instruments. Somehow he, you know, picked me up. But I do think that this broad development of a child, of a student, you know, to play some sports and, you know, be interested in music, something that does help. Another thing is also language. Mm-hmm. I learned late in my life that I could actually learn and study and learn German. Mm-hmm. I wish I had learned more Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. I started to learn Sanskrit, but my father discouraged me. He told me, you know, why are you learning Sanskrit? It's a dead language. You don't need it. And then I tried to learn Hindi. I didn't, you know, I learned a little bit, not much. You know, of course, my mother language is Tamil. And English, obviously, you know, and I can speak and understand German, and I learned a little bit of French, a little bit of Spanish, but I think learning another language opens your mind, and it also helps you to communicate with other cultures, you know, and being interested in other cultures and understanding different points of view. You know, I one time in my life, I studied the religions carefully. I studied Islam. Actually, I studied Islam from somebody who was well versed in it. I studied Christianity in great detail. You know, I'm interested in Taoism, Shintoism, all these things, because it helps you to understand where that person is coming from. You know, opens your mind.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I don't know how much you realize this, but, you know, for many neurosurgeons who are from South Asian background, I mean, you know, you are the one who broke all the ceilings. You know, you are the role model. You know, you reach the Everest, and everyone now, when every South Asian neurosurgeon knows, look, Dr. Shekhar achieved it. I can achieve it. I think you would not know that contribution that you have done to, you know, the South Asian neurosurgeons. That's immeasurable. So that's, you know, that's to your skull base, your vascular, your neurosurgery as a human touch, you know, that's inspirational. You know, you come from Tamil culture, old yep. culture, same as me.
Yes.
I'm sure, you know, Brahmin family, Orthodox family, you know, goes through millennia of culture. How did you make the transition when you came to America? Because it's a very proud tradition. One of the oldest cultures and richest cultures, and how would you make that transition coming into the American society and blending or but not losing?
Yeah, that's a very good question. What's interesting that you perhaps you experience it in a different way coming from Sri Lanka. As a Tamilian Sri Lanka, you were somewhat under attack. Let's say. Believe me, growing up in Tamil Nadu, I was so proud of everything Tamil. And I have read so much about history. Thirukkural, which is a very famous set of poems written by a man called Thiruvalluvar. He gave the lot of guidelines about how to follow life. And I actually went to Tamil medium school all the way up until college, where it just switched to English medium. And I was highly groomed in a lot of things Tamil. You know, I was well proud of everything Tamil. At the same time, what I didn't understand and realize at the time, which became more obvious when I came up, was that I was a marked man. I was a target without being actually so, simply because I was born in a Brahmin family. And there was a very active, culture of anti-Brahmin feeling in Tamil Nadu. So as a Brahmin, I would not have been eligible for, you know, colleges. I couldn't get into them. I couldn't get a job. Even if I was in the top 3%, you know, it would have been very difficult. It was very difficult. So I left India, let us say, under, an open mind. I wanted to get out of India. I didn't want to be living there because I felt that people hated me. You know, it's that feeling. When I came to the US, what I understood was that, you know, there was some discrimination, but I realized that the society is a very open society. Even though there is racism, it's a much more open society. When one person closed the door, 10 people opened the doors for you. To give you an example, I was at Cook County Hospital in Chicago. And there was a gentleman by the name of Robert Moody. He was the chief of neurosurgery there. So I went and, you know, worked in neurosurgery. And then I, was there for 3 months as an intern. Then I went and spoke to Dr. Moody. Dr. Moody, I'm really interested in neurosurgery. Can I be a resident in your program? He looked at me and said, Dr. Shekhar, I don't like foreign graduates coming to the U.S. and working in neurosurgery. On the other hand, I like to encourage women and minorities to work in neurosurgery. So I was so upset, you know, I said, what is this? You know, then I went and talked to several friends of mine that are at Cook County Hospital, and a lot of people from India. And they said, Shekhar, Don't worry about this man. Just go and ask him, will he give you a recommendation? Mm-hmm. So I went back and I said, Dr. Moody, will you be able to give me a recommendation? He said, absolutely. You've done a phenomenal job. I'll give you a write a letter of recommendation for any program you want to go to. So then I found out that there were so many other people, you know, south or north, it doesn't matter, many different parts of the country. They were very happy to see me. And, you know, and I found this everywhere in the U.S. You know, you find racist attitudes, even today, somewhere, some places, you know, black people being discriminated against, various types of minorities. But at the same time, there are lots of people, you know, very, very open-minded. It's the same thing about the religion, you know, the Hinduism, they don't care what you are, they're very open-minded. So it's a very unique country, so I was able to easily adjust. And of course, because I married an American person, that also, you know, perhaps helped me to integrate. So I felt like I was already an American, you know, somehow I felt like this is where I belonged. However, having said this, I went back to my Indian roots. So I studied all the philosophies, Indian philosophies. I started interacting with India, people from India and Tamil Nadu, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, all these other people from different backgrounds, which I didn't have the opportunity as a child, you know, because growing up in Madras, you just met your friends who were there. And then I started to read philosophy and so on. Then I realized that, well, okay, these people, they were, you know, anti-Brahmin or whatever at the time. They had a reason for it, but it is just a small segment of society, and it's my job to educate them, and I my job to give back. So I go and, you know, give conferences, I train a lot of fellows and so forth. So, and I realized that, you know, somehow I was so fortunate to have been born in India, where, you know, it was so much philosophy and history and all these other things. So I went back to the roots as well. And I feel that, you know, you mentioned about South Asian, this is wonderful, but I feel that I'm actually a citizen of the world. Some of my very close friends are in the UK, they are in Netherlands, Germany, France, China, Japan, South America, of course in the US, a lot of them in the US, Canada. But I feel like, okay, these are all my friends. They're like my family, you know. So we are one family. So I feel like that, you know. So
that's brilliant. I want to thank you very much. I want to conclude this reminiscing on the first time I met you. I think it was the San Diego WANS. It was 2006. I had put a poster on aneurysm, unruptured aneurysm calculator. And I remember you were going with your residents and fellows looking at poster. And I remember seeing you and absolutely excited and came to you and said, Dr. Sherger, you need to come and see my poster. And, you know, you kindly came and saw it. And that was the beginning of your mentoring of me and support to the listserv. And, you know, it's a great honor and privilege knowing you and learning from you. And thank you very much for your time. And I'm sure many people will listen to this and learn and reflect. Thank you very much for your 30 minutes, which is now almost 1.5 or 2 hours. Thank you very much, sir.
I want to say something, Naren. I met you and I remember very well our initial meetings. And then you became a faculty member in our department. You also came and gave some lectures. What I really want to appreciate is all of these international meetings and conferences, educational seminars that you have organized. It must have been a tremendous amount of effort for you, but I have met so many wonderful people through your efforts. And I have to say that you, to me, are one of the most prominent neurosurgeons from the UK. And yet, I'm always proud that you are of a Tamil background. This is a very special feeling that you are a Tamilian, and you know, you are doing so much to help young people and educate them and so on. And I hope and wish you the very best in your career, and also to all the people that are listening to this you know, podcast, that wish them the very best.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Okay.
Really
have a good
appreciate
day.
it.
Yeah.
Wishing
bye
you a good day. Thank you. Bye for now.